The theater. The theater.
Bring out Louis.
Theater. Theater.
To be or not to be.
Theater. Theater.
Hey friends, how do?
How do?
It's good to see you.
Yeah. Yes. Happy Tuesday. We record normally on Tuesdays.
And yeah, we're actually recording on a Tuesday.
Wow, yeah, we've been rescheduling a lot, but this time we're actually doing it on the Tuesday. It's kind of nice. Hi, it's good to see your faces this
good
lovely
to see
Tuesday.
Your faces.
Agreed.
Yeah. I want to say something very quickly. I think everybody should go, if you're listening in, you're probably here for Euripides, right? But the episode we did before this is the ending of our many, many series of CJ picks of James McClure plays.
Mm-hmm,
it's called
mm-hmm.
Laundry and Bourbon. Yeah. It's maybe one of my favorite episodes we've ever done.
No
we were
shit.
We were in the zone.
I just re-listened to it. It's really fun. It's one I think a lot of people wouldn't actively like click on if they didn't know our pod very well because it's
sure.
a random play, right? But we get into nonsense. we did so much.
Yeah.
It was fun. It was a good episode.
It was a fun one.
That's all. I think everybody should go check it out.
Good series, too.
It's a good series.
Lone Star, the first part was great, too.
It's a good series. But I did want to shout out something, and thank you, CJ, for reminding me before we started recording. But last week, theater community, you might have seen on our Instagram, we lost a massive part of our family. Nathan Lewis Jackson was a playwright and also TV writer. He wrote on Luke Cage mm-hmm. and SWAT and a bunch of great stuff like that. But was a playwright that worked a lot with Marcia Norman as an apprentice and a student, and I think a bit with Paula Vogel. And he went to Juilliard, actually, for playwriting. And I was lucky enough to work with him when I was in college. He came and did a playwriting masterclass. He's from Kansas City, I believe. So he came mm-hmm. back and did a masterclass, and I had one of my pieces read out loud during the class and ended up getting notes from him about it afterwards and actually like working on it with him for a little while. And he's the one who sort of turned it into what it became, that ended up going to Serial Killers at the Broadwater and getting second place and that and like doing mm-hmm. all this stuff. So it's a script that has had a life after. I have a lot of friends in Kansas City who knew him well, specifically shout out to friend Eric Meixelsperger, who was dear friends with Nathan and his family and actually just directed his son in a Shakespeare Youth Program production. So it's just, it's so sad. It's so mm-hmm. awful to lose someone that young. He's 44.
Yeah. Oof.
Ugh,
yeah,
just the worst.
Well, condolences to his family. Condolences to you. It's mm-hmm. It's always sad when we lose a good artist who probably hadn't hit his prime yet.
Absolutely.
24, so yeah,
exactly. But if you get a chance, go check out his plays. Look them up where you can, and maybe we'll do an episode or even a mini series on him sometime. Just to in honor.
Mm-hmm.
I think that'd be fun.
Yeah.
And we can get Eric on for that, who knew him a lot better than I did. But he was a part of this community that we love so much. The reason why the three of us are friends, the reason why this podcast exists, it is theatre. Yes?
Theatre.
And, here we do die on the hill that theater R-E is the art form and theater E-R is the building. Hence our name, Theater Theater. So welcome to Theater Theater, the theater podcast for theater nerds made by three theater makers from the L.A. theater scene. I'm Jay Bailey Bertram.
I'm C.J. Merriman.
And I'm Scott Leggett.
True. And each week we get together to discuss and debate the definition of theater through various lenses. And this week we return to form to discuss the evolutions of the great playwrights by taking a macro look at three of their plays. It's something we used to do for three whole seasons, and now we just do it sometimes. This is part one of three of our mini-series covering the works of Euripides.
This is fun. I'm excited.
This
we're going in the way back machine.
Yes, this was CJ's pick this year. Scott's pick, do you remember what your pick was, Scott? Was it Brandon Jacobs Jenkins?
Oh, they my pick have... was also Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Right, you did have, you had two picks. I think you guys each had two picks, and I had one. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Brandon Jacob Jenkins
was your other one.
Jenkins, Jingleheimer Schmidt.
Yeah, Jingleheimer Schmidt.
Sorry, sir.
Yeah, yeah.
For mispronouncing, but yeah, it's a tongue, it's a mouthful.
Because I think McDonough was my choice this year, and then Fast Horse and the other one were Scott's.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's been a barn burner of a year.
Oh,
like,
man, we're kicking ass.
The stuff we've covered's been fucking great.
I know.
Even though the format has changed, who gives a shit?
Also, I think I might have figured out that we might have figured out a way to still get Larissa on the podcast. Have I told you guys that?
No. No.
So without there being a show in LA, we might still get a little interview from her. It might be short and sweet, and it might just be Maddox and her. But we're gonna make it happen.
That's awesome. Right. I'd love that.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'm talking to their her agents. Anyway, Euripides now. We joked on previous episodes about the name of this miniseries that we were gonna call it Euripides Nuts.
Yeah.
Now it's crass. It's vulgar. I like
what
it.
What is most
what?
Of the show?
What?
Yeah.
You said that with a straight. You said that with a straight face. As
I know.
If
I know.
We, like as we have. For a year, for the first several seasons, our catchphrase was that mouths and butts were the same things.
Which is still true to this day.
Which is true. It is scientifically and biologically true.
It is true. I wanted to throw out some other options just in case.
Hit me. Mm-hmm.
Okay. These are untested.
Kay. Okay.
So there's the play Hippolytus.
Uh-huh.
Hippodcastus. It's a little sweaty and a little dirty, and I like it.
Yeah.
I don't like that one anymore. The Trojan Women.
Okay.
The Trojan Podcast.
Okay.
The Podcast Women.
Okay.
The Tropod Wimcast. I don't know. We could go real hard on that.
Right, yeah.
I like Iphigenia in Podcast.
Uh-huh.
Because he has two Iphigenia in blank plays, so that could be funny.
Right.
And then there's Phoenician Women, and I was thinking... Podcastian women.
Podcastian women.
Podcastian women.
And then there's Cyclops, where we could do psych pods.
Podclops.
Podclops. Cyclops.
Oh, man. Well, a lot of those are good, actually.
What was the first one again?
The first was Hippolytus or Hippodcastus.
I kind of like that. That's one.
I hate it.
Yeah, it's a good one.
I couldn't get it to work with any of the ones we're actually covering. Trojan Women doesn't really work. I don't know. The Podcast Women. It's not funny. I don't like it.
I'm sorry. I'm off notes. So we're doing this week. We're doing Medea. Then we're doing Trojan Women. And then what's our third?
Did someone choose? I don't even remember.
I didn't even know.
I thought
that
we were
going to
do Electra.
Are we?
We can do Electra. That'd be
Let's
fun.
Do Electra.
Electra's my favorite American gladiator from the 90s, y'all.
True. I will say this, though. If we're talking, like expanse of, you know, evolution of the playwright, Electra and Trojan Women are within 5 years of each other.
Mm.
Oh.
There's, like, a lot later and a lot earlier. Medea is 431 BC. Electra is 420 BC. Blaze.
420?
Trojan Women. Yeah, Trojan Women is 415.
Okay.
But then you have, like, Bacchae is 405. Iphigenia and Aulis is 405. If we wanted to, like, redo Bacchae, since we kind of did a different version of it. But I don't know. We've already really talked about Bacchae. So. The Orestes is 408. I don't know. I'm down with Electra. Let's just fucking do Electra. Who cares?
So Trojan Women and Electra?
Yeah.
Those are the big ones. Those are
bunch
big
of lady
ones,
plays.
Too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We like lady plays.
We like lady plays.
Could do Heracles.
All right.
Why don't we do Hercules?
Same shit.
Sorry.
Can we watch the Disney movie?
No.
Should we just do that movie?
Yeah, let's just do that movie. I love that movie.
Danny DeVito's best performance?
No.
I'm kidding.
Rip Torn also, y'all.
Who is he in that?
Zeus.
He was Zeus.
Was he?
Yes, he is.
That rules. And James Woods? James Wood.
Yes.
Wood.
He's great in that.
He's great in a lot of things. That's what's unfortunate about who he is. He's actually really good.
Actually really good.
That's what's upsetting about James Woods.
He's a prick.
Yeah, he's a piece of shit. Okay. Well, first of all, it's Euripides nuts. I think that's what we're going with. I don't know. I think it's too funny to not go for.
All right.
If anybody has a problem with it, they can email us at writermanager.com.
You know how we solve this problem? You spell nuts N-U-T-Z. Then they know that we're trying to be funny. Nuds.
You're right. You're right. Euripides nuds.
Yeah.
You're right.
I'm in. Yeah.
Golden comedy.
Yes.
Top
Aristophanes
tier.
Would be fucking proud.
He would. Okay. Well, so to start off, before we get into Medea, which is what we're talking about today, which was CJ's pick?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I want to make sure that we all know who Euripides was and is still in our hearts, right?
Yeah.
The way that we normally do that is with a segment that I like to call the best segment. Scottpedia.
Scottpedia.
Scottpedia. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to butcher some fucking Greek names and places in the next minute. Okay.
I like it. We are the number 5 most listened to performing arts podcast in Greece, so don't fuck
it
up. Thanks, Greece.
Sorry, Greek. Greek. Sorry, Greece. Anyway.
They're already turning it off.
It's fine. Right? Stephen the Guppy Euripides. That was his frat name.
Yeah.
The Guppy.
Is he Delta Chi?
Was born on Salamis Island around 480 BC with parents Cleito, who was his mother, cool. and Menisarchus was his father. He was a retailer from the Dem of Philg. Philg. On receiving an oracle that his son was fated to win crowns of victory, quote end quote, Masarchus insisted that the boy should train for a career in athletics. But the boy was destined for a career on the stage.
Time old story.
You're gonna
My son's going to be an athlete. He ain't going to do no sissy plays.
But he was destined for the stage, where he was where he was to win only 5 victories. One of those was posthumously, and we'll get into some of the how the festivals and the prizes were given and all that as we talk through here. He served for a short time as both dancer and torchbearer at the rites of Apollo. His education was not confined to athletics, studying also painting and philosophy under the masters Prodicus. Why couldn't we that be the name? Prodicus would have been.
No, come on.
You're right.
Prodicus. Here's the other one. Anaxagoras was the other.
Sounds good.
Master.
You're doing great.
That's
right
to me.
Thank
yeah.
you. He had 2 disastrous marriages, and both his wives, Melit and Corine, the latter bearing him 3 sons, were unfaithful. You just get a cuck vibe from Euripides.
Yeah.
A little bit of a cuck vibe, maybe.
We love a cuck on this podcast.
Totally do. Yeah.
Unless it's Putin. Putin's a fucking beta.
Is he a cuck?
He's a beta cuck. Wow. I say that because he would hate to hear that. Fucking Putin.
Oh, nice. Yeah,
okay, go on.
I like betas.
I'm with betas.
Yeah. But I get what you mean. You're hitting him where it hurts, kind of.
Yes.
Thing. Yeah. Fuck you, Putin. Fuck you.
Euripides doesn't get super cool till late in life, and that's when he becomes a recluse after his 2 wives fuck around and split on him. And he ended up making a home for himself in a cave on Salamis, the cave of Euripides, where a cult of the playwright developed after his death.
Oh, that's
badass. Who
else
has that going for him?
That's awesome.
Quote, there he built an impressive library and pursued daily communion with the sea and sky.
I do that.
I do it all the time.
Yeah, every day.
The details of his death are uncertain. It was traditionally held that he retired to the rustic court of King Archelaus in Macedonia, where he died in 406 BC, but modern scholarship is skeptical of these claims. It is possible that in reality he never visited Macedonia at all, which I've been saying since undergrad.
Same, dude, same.
And, or he did, he might have been drawn there by King Archelaus with incentives that were also offered to other artists. So yeah. It seems to be... you know, shady. So along with Sophocles and Aeschylus. They need to spell it right. He is one of the three ancient Greek tragedians for whom any plays have survived in full.
Wow.
Some ancient scholars attribute 95 plays to Euripides. Of these, 18 and a half... have survived more or less complete. But neither the Medea is the first of a trilogy, and none of the sequels or the other ones survived.
The half-written play? Solomon. Yeah.
Salome. So yeah, there ends some Scottpedia for you guys. Yeah.
Thanks,
so.
Scott.
Oh, thanks, Scott. Yeah. We appreciate
so yeah,
that.
He just seemed to be, you know, from all of the other little things I read, he was just kind of a working playwright. And put shows together, and, you know, that's how he made his living. And, gosh,
imagine
being a writer, being able to make a living. Fuck you, Bill Maher. Can we digress and get into that real fast?
Let's get into Bill Maher.
Yeah, just real fast. No, he just came out this week and made a shitty comment that the writer's demands are quote unquote kooky, and that no writer deserves to make a living from writing.
What? Bill Maher made a horrible comment?
Right. Surprise. He's just going down dick territory.
Yeah.
No, he's a piece of shit. Yeah. He's always been a piece of shit. He's always been a guy who makes money off of like having the hot take. Mm-hmm. And then Joe Rogan started doing it and making even more money. And now Bill Maher's just butt hurt. So he just has to like say something every once in a while that he knows will like get him
piss
back
people
on
off,
the,
yeah. Yeah.
Speaking of beta cucks.
But imagine going beta cucks. Imagine walking into the writer's room for your Bill Maher show after the strike is over.
Fuck that guy.
You fucking prick. Like, you know. And apparently many writers have come out and said that it's been well known. Like, if you want to be treated like an ass or like a shit, go work for Bill Maher. So
shit.
Well, fuck that guy.
Fuck
Boo.
That gay. Yeah, yeah, fuck you, anyway. Bill Maher.
Bill Maher, Joe Rogan, and Putin walk into a bar.
And everyone leaves and sets the bar on fire.
Yeah.
We don't condone murder on this podcast, but yeah. Medea.
If you're gonna.
If you're gonna.
Choose wisely.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Scott.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I appreciate that. That was great. I understand him better as a human now.
Yeah, you know, he's got a little sadness and, you know,
conflict. It sounds like he, in like you said, like he like possibly wrote like 95 plays, and some of them are fragmentary and some of them are like lost or whatever. But it just sounds like he just spent all of his time writing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then once he started winning shit at the Dionysia, he started getting laid a lot. And then he started writing about that.
Yeah.
That's about it. That's what I got from your Scottopedia. Yeah.
That's, I mean, you know, what that's else it. Was there to do? You couldn't watch TV.
There's nothing else.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, let's get into our play for the day.
Mm-hmm.
The play for pay. The play for day.
Yes.
CJ.
Yes.
This was your choice.
Uh-huh.
What is it and why?
I chose Medea, and I actually, going back and thinking on this, I only read any Greek shit because they made me do it in college. So we read Medea. I think I possibly read the Bacchae at some point. I definitely know Dionysus in 69 better than the Bacchae. So, like, this is it for me. And I was like, well, I got to do Medea because, again, it was a play that it was like, I haven't read it since I was 18. And really, as far as, like, Greek anything goes, I've seen Lysistrata, a college thing, and then I've seen one other Greek tragedy. But, like, I haven't been super exposed to this stuff. But I picked Medea because I just wanted to get into it.
Word.
Word.
Yeah.
What's your relationship with it, Scott?
Man, I'll tell you.
Oh, we didn't do context for Euripides in general. But right. That sounds like that's kind of your context.
That's my context. Right. Yeah.
Okay.
So do in general and Medea, Scott. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I'll expand a little bit. So the Greeks have always been, and I haven't seen a lot, but I've seen several multiple times, Medea being one of the ones I've seen multiple times.
Yeah.
And I've seen it, but horrible, fucking awful. Like, I want to die, and I want to go home in intermission, but I can't go home in intermission.
Although it's not an intermission, huh?
Yeah, I've seen, like, yes.
Long
that's
drawn
how,
out. They try to make a cinematic
drawn out version. Yeah.
It's only a 42-page play.
I've seen very good Medeas. Mm-hmm. I saw Annette Bening do Medea at UCLA.
Oh, all right.
Also, most people don't do the original text. Most people do new versions of it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Oh,
so they call it Medea, and it's like, based on the play by Euripides. And you're like, okay. But it's like not even close. It's just the same. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of different versions of it over the years. I think my biggest issue, and I think the biggest problem I have, and again, I haven't seen some of the ones that are like, famous for their production value and for their epicness and for their awesomeness. What I've seen is a lot of what I call the grad school stance. Seen a lot of grad versions of it, which is, you know, actors who've like done all of their voice homework and they've done all of their movement homework, but I've never felt anything seeing a production of a Greek thing. Mm. And except for Medea, and the Annette Bening one was quite good, but not emotionally connecting. But I saw like a version that was 90 minutes out in the valley in 2012-ish or something like that, that was so intimate and awesome that I felt something. And so that's kind of the one that I've really kind of felt. And I also kind of think it's the best of the Greeks that survive because it does have the potential for personal stuff. Unlike Oedipus, which is kind of reduced to don't fuck your mom. Dionysus in 69 was a cool thing to watch and experience and was quite visceral. And I would love to see more of that when I go to see it. But sometimes it just feels
academic. Antigone. A good deal.
Oh, Antigone.
I like Antigone. Yeah.
I've seen productions of it that I really liked, but I would agree with you, Scott. Yeah, Antigone's a good role. I did a radio play of it once that was really fun. It was
cool.
Really
That's
good.
A good idea for Greek stuff, I'd say.
It was great. It was fun. But that was in Kansas. That was great. Medea, my Euripides, same. Read it in college, tons of it. I was in Trojan Women in college. I was Menelaus, I think.
Okay. Mm.
Yeah, that sounds right. And then I have seen Medea 9,000 times. And like you said, Scott, usually versions that I'm like, okay, well done. You did the thing.
Yeah,
never really get much from it. I did see one production, which I actually weirdly, I think I brought up recently, which was in Kansas City, and it was Shakespeare in the Park, and it was meant to be a Shakespeare in the Park type thing. It obviously wasn't Shakespeare, but they did this woman playing Medea was really, really fantastic, and they put the child murder on stage. They did the ribbon thing that I talked about where they pulled out the ribbons, but they did it in a really like harsh, fun, cool, theatrical way.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just in the whole performance, and I hadn't ever really felt that way about any other Greek stuff. So that was the first time I was like, oh, these can be good. These can be good. And then I have seen things since then. I know, like, friend of the pod, past and future guest, Casper, has, a Medea that they're sort of, like, working on right now, trying to pitch as, like, this different, weirder version of it that I'm really intrigued by. I can't say anything else about because they're trying to get it on its feet. But there's a million different versions of this thing, and there's been 100 productions that had whole new translations and whole new versions and some of them are 500 pages long and some of them are 40 pages long. And so, mm-hmm. you know, it just kind of depends on what you decide to do. I think there's an opera. There's one mm-hmm. in almost every language. I'm going to talk about productions later because there's a crazy list of them. I won't list them all. But I think my relationship with Medea is that it's always amidst the debate, the feminist debate.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Right. And I'm excited to talk about that and deep dive into that a little bit more.
I've got some interesting.
He's definitely ahead of the game considering where he was from and at what.
Well, and that's the debate.
Yeah.
That's the question. Some people are like, I don't think so. I think this is still from a misogynistic point of view, and he's showing a da da da. And some people are like, she's an anti-hero. And some people are like, this is the most feminist or like proto-feminist thing that's ever been. And I'm like, okay. Let's talk about it. And not that we are the three that will decide, but I want to talk about what the debate is. I don't know that I have an answer.
I did some Greek myth research because, I mean, for how little I've read the Greek playwrights, I love Greek myths. So, I picked up one of my mythology books and flipped through it to check some shit out. And I've got some mythological facts.
Yay.
Right.
And there's a lot of things changed from the myth to the play. Like, but there's also a lot of versions of the myth.
Well,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, as happens with Greek and Roman myths, I think the thing that really struck me was it made me think of when we were covering Shakespeare's Histories last year, and you both discussed, like, seeing this in its time and knowing all of the political and historical background going into it makes it even more interesting. And this is a myth that the Athenians would know, and knowing all of the backstory that goes into it before we even get here with Jason and Medea makes the play richer also.
Yeah. Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah. 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 Okay. Okay. What do we want to talk about? Do we start with form? Do we start broad picture?
Do you want to hear the basic bitch breakdown?
Fine.
Let's do it.
CJ's breakdown. Medea has been publicly betrayed by her fuckboy husband, Jason, who is setting her aside for King Creon's daughter. After everything she's done for him and given up, and this is how he repays her? Well, you better watch the fuck out, Jason, because Medea is coming for everything you love and have gained with a double order of filicide.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's like Clueless with murder.
Right.
No, I'm just kidding. It's funny, though, we've been talking a lot about vengeance, Scott. You and I have been talking about vengeance a lot with our Park Chan-wook rewatches. And,
well, he was a philosophy major, and so, you know.
Oh.
Greeks and philosophers and all that good stuff. I think that the first thing that struck me, and the version I kind of read and watched didn't go into it, and you brought it up, and you did a very funny bit, CJ, with, you know, after everything I've done for you.
Yeah,
she did a fuck ton that isn't necessarily...
He wouldn't have been a hero if it wasn't for her.
She literally killed members of her own family. She made it so she can't ever go back to Corinthia.
Mm-hmm.
Corinthia. And so the weight of that needs to be in there. I think that's something an audience would have known and been aware of, you know?
Yeah.
And also, I think that what's interesting, and this is where, like, the proto-feminist stuff comes up, it's her against Jason. Jason and the fucking Argonauts, bro. They were rock stars back in the day. Like, they just
Avengers. If you put them in a play, people were like, oh shit.
The Argonauts are here, man. Fuck yeah. And so.
But at this point, Jason has also kind of just left the Argonauts to their own devices. Like, he won and he got his girl, and then he got his
golden fleece, and now he's trying to go. He's climbing the ladders.
He's a Vita.
Sleeping his way to the top. But he's going to get his. He fucked around and he's going to find out. Like, it's cool in that sense.
Yeah. it's all... Okay, so we'll start with the fact that this is... It's sort of known that this is a more simple play. than a lot of Greeks. And I think that's why we maybe as a modern audience appreciate or like it a little bit more, because we like two-person scenes. We like drama between two people. And this is that. And it's kind of the first and only time where that's part of it, right? You have the chorus, obviously. But besides that, there's so many two-person scenes, like just Medea and one other person.
Right.
And I think that's what we love, yeah.
It's also the specificity of that chorus.
Yeah.
That they are specifically the women.
The women of Corinth.
The Corinth, yeah.
And so that also just sort of adds to the, because you get through them, you get her inner stuff as well. And the panic about it, like when they start to figure out what she's going to do, like that's interesting to me. It's really, yeah. And I saw it with I've seen it with a large chorus and I've seen it with three. I love it. Like it works either way. You can do huge or small.
Yeah. Yeah. But I like the idea of doing this real intimate. I like the idea of making this real, real small. I mean, obviously, it would have been done in, like, the big Grecian, you know, type theater. But I think maybe at the Dionysia it wasn't. Maybe it was a smaller stage. I don't know. I don't know what any of that was about. But the fact that we get to see her in these tiny scenes, we get to see... And I like the idea of it being intimate, like a little black box.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, seeing her really... play with these people and use her power and manipulate.
It weirdly made me think of Fences a little bit, because the entire play is done on somebody's porch, right in front of somebody's front door. Right. The entire fucking play.
That's true.
You know what it reminded me of?
Other plays that do that. What?
Doll's House.
Oh. Okay. Yeah, sure.
Done in one room.
Well, the thing I kept reading too was... also that you have... A woman who abandons her children, that it is super, you know, feminist play. Another play that gets labeled as proto-feminist.
Well, and then another thing, you could even call this a melodrama if you wanted to, which makes it a little bit like A Doll's House too.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's, yeah, and that simplicity, again, I think lends itself so much to those small black box productions. That one I saw out in the valley was, I mean, it was done in proscenium kind of thing, but it was just so intimate. It was so like you were in her, you were with her the whole time. It was mesmerizing.
Well, and that's interesting too, because these plays were never done in an intimate situation. They were done in a big fucking amphitheater where everyone had to yell to be heard. So that is very interesting.
I mean, you can do the same trick with Shakespeare. Was, you know, doing that in small intimate spaces. Really can be really super powerful.
Mm-hmm. What are you saying, Paige?
Nothing. I was agreeing.
I agree.
This was interesting. I found this. The play is the only Greek tragedy in which someone who kills a family member makes it unpunished to the end of the play.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the only one about child killing in which it happens in cold blood as opposed to in a state of temporary madness.
Mm-hmm.
Like
the Bacchae.
Right. It happens on purpose and not because they're like, oh, no, I don't know what I'm doing. Right.
Right.
That was kind of interesting to me because I was like, wait, there's so many Greek tragedy. There's got to be more, but apparently not.
No, and that's cool because... We also get into, you know, she is what, the granddaughter of Helios,
the sun god. Yeah.
Yeah. And so she gets the chariot and all that shit, too, at the end.
The thing that I wanted to bring up about what you were saying, Bailey, and something that the Greeks would know watching this back in the day because of her myths, was Medea was a tool of the gods. She fell in love with Jason because Hera wanted her to fall in love with him.
Right.
Aphrodite and Eros made her fall in love with him because Hera wanted him to get the golden fleece so they could eventually kill Peleos, because Peleos like said she had a fat ass or something. So she wanted him dead. And then after this love spell, she stuck with him, and then she kills her brother so that they can escape her father, and then she talks the daughters into killing the other king and all that stuff. So the reason why that I read that possibly she isn't punished for this is Jason is an oath breaker. He broke his oath to her. Zeus is the protector of oaths. So in a way, Medea is meting out punishment to Jason that he deserves in the first place.
Word.
So is she doing, like, if you're thinking in the grand scheme of the gods, is she doing what she is supposed to be doing? I just found that very interesting when I was
Absolutely. Yeah, which adds to the whole melodrama thing you were talking
right.
about.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, exactly. In the original myth, she does not kill her children.
Right.
The
not in
people.
Hesiod or Pindar's. Pindar, Pindar's.
Right, right, myths. Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's like a mob of people.
That kill the kids?
That kill the kids mm. in anger, I believe, is what I read. I could be wrong. But so I think dramatically, though, and this sort of leads us into the debate that is often had about the feminism and whatever is, you know, why she kills her children, why she chooses to in the end. Hmm. And is that the ultimate form of mercy for her children, or is it evil, or is it, you know, I think is the question that, because I a lot of people, it'd be like a modern day Medea when a woman like kills her children.
Yeah,
sure.
Right? And you're always
yes.
like, oh, and so. So I guess in my head, before I was introduced to Medea, Medea was like an evil thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When I read this, it's not that. The lens of this play, we are on her side.
Yeah.
We feel her
sure.
struggle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Jason's a fuckboy.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, except that I like Jason and the Argonauts. I like that story. But then mm-hmm. you get into this story and, oh, shit. I unplugged my headphones.
We should watch the Harryhausen.
Yeah.
Jason and the Argonauts. Yeah.
Jason. Oh, yeah.
I haven't seen that in years. And then we'll watch the good Clash of the Titans.
The good Clash of the Titans. We already committed you to something, Bailey. While
what?
Were,
no, what?
While your headphones. We're going to watch Jason and the Argonauts, the Harryhausen.
And the Clash of the Titans.
And mm-hmm. then Clash of the Titans.
Yeah. They both rule.
Yeah. No.
We're not watching the new ones.
No. Fuck those.
No.
They made me so mad.
I have the DVD of both, I think, if we need them.
The oldies?
Yeah.
I definitely bought the Clash of the Titans, but I don't have Jason the Argonauts. anyway, you know, this time around reading this, and I have to say, I read the translation from the one that I found from Scribd for us was Michael Collier, which I don't know who that is. It was incredibly contemporary and easy to read.
Mm.
And then the one that I listened to was Gilbert Murray, and it was all old English and flowery language all over the place.
Mm,
and
sure.
I think, I mean, the contemporary one was easily accessible. I think I want something kind of in the middle for it, though.
Mm. Yeah.
But what were we saying? Oh, fuck. I just
feminism.
Had a trip. No, what? It'll come back to me. Sorry.
No.
Well,
no.
I want to know your answer. Like, go ahead.
Talking about whose side you're on, something that I picked up this time in the more contemporary reading is the nurse. The nurse had a line that said, "Privilege provides a license for her violent moods." Then it made me think of the Corinthian women. The people whose side I'm on are the people that are the slaves and the people that are middle-class people watching these celebrities act insane.
Right.
And
right,
the
right.
nurse doesn't want any, like, the nurse doesn't like Jason, but she doesn't want the kids to be killed. And it's the same with the Corinthian women, though how they reacted in both versions that I read and listened to were different, which was interesting to me.
Hmm. Yeah. And again, you know, there's so much room to play with. You could take two or three different translations, versions that have been done over the years and really kind of fuck with them. Like, I'm surprised somebody hasn't done something like a metal musical. Like, it would be badass to just have like Medea rocking, like
there's
wailing.
A gay pride musical.
Oh yeah,
of Medea.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
Get into
I'd be
it.
Down for that.
We'll get into it. Yeah, I have that whole list. I want to list for you guys.
Because like I'd be interested to know the Corinthian women in the new contemporary version that I read. They knew everything that was going to happen, and then they stood by. They said, "Don't do it," but then they stood by and let it happen. In the recording that I listened to, some of them stood by and some of them ran to the door and tried to get the door open and pull the children out.
Mm.
Which was, those are two completely different things to
yeah,
me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
Now that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want to know officially, what side are you on the debate about this play in terms of feminist views? What is it, a feminist play? Is it quote unquote proto-feminist? Is it actually from, you know, a totally different lens and we just read it that way because we choose to? Is this a time where maybe he was allowed to say things like this in art, or is it something, or is he not saying something that's that provocative at the time? I don't know.
Wow, that's a really great question. I must say that I really love that it has been taken and turned into a feminist play. I'm mm-hmm. glad that you can play with those things, and I don't think you can escape them now. I think if you, anybody who's approaching that role, you're talking about a woman who has been scorned, a woman who's been abused, a woman who's been forsaken, a mother that has been put into a horrible situation. Because there's also the financial aspect that they keep talking about. Jason claims that he's doing this to secure his son's future. You know?
Yeah.
And, right. And yeah, that's probably a secondary benefit, but she doesn't have any option. Like, she doesn't, like, who's getting custody? What's, like, how's that going to all play out? Mm. So I imagine maybe it was kind of an accidental thing, like a playwright exploring a myth, going through, developing a character, thinking through that character's journey, thinking through the drama of it and how to, and why wouldn't you take that stance? You know, I'm not up on Greek, ancient Greek sociology. Like,
that's the thing.
Really,
I don't know.
Hard to know.
I don't know what their stance on gender is in
yeah.
this time.
Yeah.
And I kind of want to figure that out. And I feel like I definitely learned about it at some point in high school or whatever, and I just don't remember, you know. But like, I wonder if there's sort of, he's just like, I'm just writing a character.
Mm.
Right. If there's more to it than that, or if he really is like saying something here and this is a big deal. But then, it, you know, I think Antigone would be considered feminist then. And so mm-hmm. would a lot of these, Electra. Well, maybe not Electra, but, you know,
maybe Elister, but yeah.
The little bit of reading I did was that this play would have pissed off the Athenians watching it because of how they did view and treat women.
Yeah, I read something similar when the play was in competition at whatever, it won second place. Mm-hmm. It didn't win first place. And that might have been because it riled people up.
So it was
I think it's feminist of its time, because he talks about not only Medea but the princess being victims of marriage. Mm. And they compare childbirth to going to war. Like,
are those real things, or is that something that the translator or playwright put? You know what I always wonder that.
Sure, sure.
I'm not questioning CJ.
That's a valid thing to be asking.
It's also such old shit.
Sure. You know, there's also just the idea of, and again, this could be a translation thing, the idea, and this is a time old thing in a lot of different plays, the idea of a clever woman being a threat to male security.
Mm.
You need women mm-hmm, to like sit mm-hmm. back and be quiet and follow the rules. And she doesn't know how to do that. She doesn't do that. And she, in fact, knows how to kind of like get herself out of a shitty situation.
Sure.
And that's scary to the men. And as soon as she starts running her mouth, then they want her out of there because they know she's dangerous. So that could be a misogynistic thing, or it could be him holding a mirror up to society. So yeah, I guess we don't fucking know. It feels feminist to me. I feel like if you do it now, it would be feminist if you got the right people doing it.
Yeah,
it's not...
I think the director would have to, wouldn't have to work very hard to make it feminist, but I think it would also it'd be easy for a director to be like, she's crazy. She's the crazy woman in the attic. And,
yeah.
And it would be easy to direct it that way. It would not be fun to watch.
No.
But I think you could do it.
You could make it a farce and do it that way, I guess.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Yeah, you could play
have spaghetti coming out of the children.
Yeah.
Well, I mean that, and that's the one cool thing about all of the Greeks is that you're dealing with so many of these crazy archetypes and bold myths and legends that we all are kind of familiar with that you can fuck with it. Plus, ain't nobody gonna sue you for copyright.
That's right.
Mm. So, like, who was it recently? It was like, what's your writing advice? It's like, steal from Shakespeare.
you won't
be better than that, and ain't nobody gonna sue you for it.
Exactly.
So it's like,
exactly. It sounds real pretty.
You know what
I would love to see? I would love to see, you know, like Peter Pan goes wrong, play that goes wrong, but Medea goes wrong. They should do that.
Get
they
dark.
Go back to like some true.
Oh, that would get dark though. Child
Greek tragedy stuff. I don't know. Yeah. It'd be very fun.
Yeah.
You just make it so that it doesn't work, like the blood packs don't work, and they're like, whatever, you know, I don't know, do something. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, can I go through a few of the productions of this thing that have happened that are kind of famous?
Do it.
So, I'll start with film because there's been some really famous films.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, there is the Pier Paolo Pasolini, maker of such films as Salo, 120 Days of Sodomy, and things like, right?
Yeah.
You know, legend of Italian film. Made one in 1969.
69.
Nice. And there's like four other, you know, movie versions of it. And I think there was even one in like 2021.
Right.
Like there's just one every few years. Like someone makes another one. There's been a bunch of television versions of it. There's been 1,000 translations. Anyway, so then productions of it, and these are not just necessarily productions, but like adaptations more so, because none of them really stick to the original text or translation. So you have, there's that really famous poster that is the play Medea.
Yeah.
It's Medee. And there's, if you look up the poster, it's Sarah Bernhardt. And the poster, I have like a puzzle of the poster. It's like a very famous poster. So it's that's the only reason I knew that. There's a version in 1946 in France. The first one to win a Tony Award for the woman playing Medea was in 1947 with Judith Anderson, largely considered like the greatest actress of
her day,
1900s. It was directed by John Gielgud.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
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 Yeah. So it did its thing. I think it started on the West End and then went to Broadway. And then you have Medea in Disneyland, which is a parody that takes place in Walt Disney, inside of Walt Disney animated cartoon.
Oh,
okay.
Wow.
Shit.
And this was off-Broadway in the 50s.
Okay.
So, sounds dope.
Yes.
Canada's Stratford Festival did a version of it. They did a version in 1983 called Kabuki Medea.
Oh, yeah.
That was
that's
just
very
a Kabuki
famous.
Medea, very famous. And it ended up going to Chicago. There was a one set in a Caribbean island called Pekong in 1990. Let's see. I'm trying to find the other. There's a parody called Medea in 1993. There's a dance theater retelling. There's here we go. Medea the Musical! Reinterprets the play in light of gay culture.
Okay.
Sounds great. 1994, Berkeley, California.
All right.
Christopher Durang and Wendy Wasserstein.
Oh, yeah. I knew about this.
Co-wrote a sketch version for the Juilliard School's drama 25th anniversary in 1994, and it has been done everywhere. People do it all the time for, like, benefits and whatever. I guess.
That's fun.
Sounds great. National Theater of Greece launched a worldwide tour of Medea, which was critically acclaimed. Neil LaBute, motherfucker, wrote Medea Redux, which is a bad play. Have you ever read Medea Redux?
No. It was Callista Flockhart. Everyone was doing those Redexes a couple years ago.
Yeah, Callista Flockhart in 1999. And it's a one act, and it's, yeah, it's bad. Lacuza, John, Michael Lacuza of Wild Party fame, the good Wild Party,
created a
Broadway musical adaptation for Audra McDonald.
Okay.
It was called Marie Christine. And it's people, I think, do it sometimes.
Okay.
But it was, as if it was set in 1890s New Orleans.
Hmm.
Okay.
Kind of cool. There's a bunch of okay. I mean, I'm skipping through some stuff now. I'm sorry, guys.
No.
There was a Wesley Enoch version in 2000 called Black Medea, which was at Sydney Theatre Co. Big deal. There's Peter Stein directed a Medea. It was called Medea in Epidaurus.
Okay.
Marina Carr, the Irish playwright, wrote a modern retelling called By the Bog of Cats.
I would like to visit a bog of cats.
Yeah, yeah. They staged a really massive production at the Library of Alexandria in Egypt, which sounds fucking rad.
Yes.
Latina playwright Caridad Svich wrote Wreckage, which is a 2009 modern retelling. There's a thousand. There's a billion. There was one other really exciting one that I wanted to make sure I shouted out.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, talk amongst yourself.
There's the Helen McCrory version was supposed to have been astounding.
Okay.
It was called like
Was that the gal that played Draco Malfoy's mom?
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, by the way, when John Gielgud directed it on Broadway, he also played Jason.
Of course he did.
With a douche. Yeah. I think that's it. But it's the only play ever. It's the only character and the only play to have, you know, three... More than one, actually. Tony won for the same role.
Hmm.
Wow. Wow, that makes sense.
It has three.
Yeah.
Which is kind of rad.
Hmm.
That's interesting. Cool. I haven't thought about that. Like, there's no Lady M's in there? Multiple Lady M's or Ophelia's?
Nope. Most recent was 1994 Diana Rigg won.
Wow.
Cool. Yeah.
Yes.
Oof, that would have been... That would have been rad.
Olenna Tyrell.
Yeah.
And Zoe Caldwell won it in 1982, who's also a, you know, massive
deal. Yeah, she's a legend. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. She's also in The Purple Rose of Cairo, a movie that I forgot to shout out when we were shouting out Jeff Daniels movies the other day when CJ was talking about Jeff Daniels.
I thought this was going to be another Jim Broadbent thing for a minute.
Well, maybe. He's in everything. But yeah, those are all, I was just interested in that. I always love knowing like what productions have been done. And there's been so many massive, like super famous productions of this. And it's just, it has withstood the test of time even more so than anything Shakespeare ever wrote. I mean, obviously, because it's older, but.
Shakespeare's pulling his material from their stuff.
That's right. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's all I have to say about it. What do you got? You guys have anything else?
I just think the thing that excites me about revisiting this, and it makes me excited to read these other plays too, is they give you context clues to the characters, whether you've read the myths or just through the dialogue. It's not like a modern day play where you're told how old they are and their personality and maybe what they look like at the beginning of the script. Sure. And I think so long as somebody has a strong vision for this, there's so many different ways you can go with a lot of the characters in the show. And that's what's exciting to me.
Right.
You can play things a million, like the, I just had to mention the reading that I listened to. The guy playing Jason was such a whiny little bitch the whole time. And I was like, I never would have thought of Jason as this way. He was literally like, Medea, the whole time. But I was like, I wouldn't have thought of Jason this way. But it's a new way you can fadge it out. And that's exciting to me.
Well, and some people do make Jason a sympathetic figure, and they make him the one being manipulated.
Sure.
Right? Rather than the opportunist sort of thing. And I think that's when we start getting into, like, who your director is and whether they're a misogynist or not.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Scott, do you have any final say on Medusa?
No, it was interesting revisiting it. Like I said, I'd seen that production with Annette Bening. That was really, really bold. It was directed by, let me get this right. Lenka Udovicki, who's a Croatian director of opera and like big sort of sprawling classics like this. And it was like set in kind of a Middle
and also
Eastern.
From that area, yeah. A little bit.
Yeah, and this, like, there was a giant wall. It was sort of semi-modern set. Like, it was interesting. And Angus McFadden was in it as Jason, and was kind of brought, like, a lot of, you know, levity to it. Not levity to it, weight to it. And so just... And listen, I love that it's around and that people continue to play with it and experiment with it. I really want to see one that, like, just, I got to see that lovely one out in the valley, but I would really love to see somebody just really get to me emotionally, which is the challenge for all of the Greeks for me. Faux me.
Yeah, agreed.
No.
Well, this was fun. We have two whole episodes left about Euripides' nuts. The second episode, we're going to do his chronology. We're going to step through everything he's done. I'm not going to do all the fragmented stuff. I might pull out a couple that are interesting, but there's just so many. So many. So I'll keep it quick, and I won't go through them all. But if you have one that you're like, ooh, I know that one, we can discuss it a slight bit.
Sweet.
Okay. You guys want to shout out some LA theater?
Yes, please.
LA Spotlight.
My one, I've got A Slight Ache, a rarely done Harold Pinter play, is on at the Odyssey Theater Ensemble right now on the West Side. OdysseyTheaterRE.com. It's Thursday, Friday, Saturday at 8, Sundays at 2, and it's going through October 1st.
Yep.
I'm very excited to announce that Sacred Fools, in conjunction with Rainbow Entertainment and their Act Now class, is going to be producing a TGNC play reading festival. Cool. It's going to go from September 28th through October 2nd. More details to come, but I think that our friend of the pod, Maddox Pennington, might have a play in there.
Yay!
Nice. Friend of the pod, Nicole Dressel, might have a play in there.
Yay!
And the Act Now class is a class, acting class, of trans, non-binary, queer students, and they have been residents at the Broadwater for a while, and so to be able to collaborate with them is awesome. But there's going to be like a closing music fest. We hope to have like a trans DJ doing a dance party after it closes on that Sunday of that weekend. It's going to be in two different spaces, so keep your eyes peeled on sacredfools.org. More information and announcements will be coming soon. Yeah. And then also right after that, because I like to stay busy, I'm going to be producing, Bailey, what's it called?
Mothers of God. It's a play that Rachel and I wrote that will be done for a couple of days in 7th and 8th of October.
Yay.
At Sacred Fools.
At Sacred Fools at the Broadwater.
It's a
at
great
the Black
show,
Box.
And
very
again,
excited about it.
Yeah, keep eyes out for sacredfools.org.
Auditions are tomorrow.
Yeah.
I'm so excited.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Just keep an eye out for sacredfools.org for information on Mothers of God and the TGNC Reading Festival. It's going to be fun, a lot of cool stuff. And the cool thing for both the festival and for Mothers of God is it's going to be Donate What You Can. So you can get in to see these for whatever you can afford. And
we love that.
Everybody's going to get paid. So,
yeah.
So we're excited about all that.
Money.
So. Money, theater, let's do this.
Yes.
Sweet. Thank you for joining us for part one of Euripides' Nuts, or Hippodcastalus. I don't know. Join us next time as we discuss the Trojan women. Or no, next time we'll be Elektra.
Oh, we'll do Elektra next.
Because
yeah,
Elektra's
right.
technically
like,
before
yeah,
it.
Looking
so we'll do Elektra next, and then Trojan women.
Yes.
And then after Euripides, it'll be a Bailey's choice?
I think it's
I
a
think
Bailey's
it's
pick,
be.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's gotta be.
Have I announced what I'm doing?
No, I don't think so.
No.
I'll think about it. I don't know yet.
It just says Bailey's pick.
Yeah, that's all I have.
I might be
pick.
Doing okay. another miniseries within a miniseries, nonsense. And we're just going to only do nonsense. No, we're gonna only do Mencken projects.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
That's kind of fun, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Going all the way back or just starting with Little Shop?
I might choose just like three and we'll just do cool. like as if it's like its own playwright miniseries, but it's its own thing. Yeah.
All right,
I think
cool.
that'd be fun. Because like we can do like fucking Little Mermaid and
Little Mermaid.
And
yeah.
Only things with the word little in the title.
All right. I'm in.
He also did the soundtrack to Little Giants, the Rick Moranis.
No shit.
No, he didn't.
Yeah. Oh, that would have been rad.
Gosh, that would have been cool, yeah. Remember Rick Moranis? We love Rick Moranis.
Hell yeah. Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. That was big for me.
Also about little. It was little for you is what it was.
Yeah, it was very little for me.
Strange brew, dude.
Strange brew, dude.
We found this rat in our beer, eh? Yeah. And so we're coming here for free beer. It might be one of my favorite moments in film history. As you see the bottle with the rat in it.
I saw Strange Brew really young.
Yeah,
and
me
still
too.
Thought it was really funny. But it was, yeah, okay. Okay, that's all.
Do y'all have questions or comments? You can reach out to us via email, Instagram, Facebook, or X Twitter. Scott?
Thank you, CJ. A big shout out to Ryan Thomas Johnson, who we got to party with on Saturday. We all got to party and dance with Ryan Thomas.
It was
Johnson.
Great. It was a great night.
Oh, so good. Ryan writes our theme song. And here's an interesting fact. I found this on Wikipedia. Our motherfucking theme song is better than your motherfucking theme song.
That's right.
Boom.
Everything on Wikipedia is correct.
That's correct. hashtag fact.
Yeah.
Ryan also writes all of our stingers. He's an amazing, awesome, super talented human being. It's a pleasure to talk about him every week. And then finally, to the great award-winning playwright Carol Churchill, who just celebrated her birthday this past
week. That's
right.
Yeah. That's right. She did.
So happy birthday, Carol. Carol Churchill writes every single one of our episodes, and she doesn't even know it. And one day, Carol Churchill, we're going to buy you a beer.
It's true. Subscribe,
fact.
Rate, review. We love you guys so much. We'll see you next time. I just wanted to say also at CJ's party, we danced our butts off.
It was such a good night.
We had a great time.
And since we danced our butts off, we also danced our mouths off. Because
same
mouths and butts are the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. That was redundant, but thanks, Scott. Because they're the same. They're the same. But mouth. We also got to scream the Carl Anderson version of Heaven on Their Minds at
dramatic,
the top of our
yeah,
lives, and that was really fun. So thank you for that.
Yes.
Wait for me. I'm coming. Wait, I'm coming with you. Wait for me. I'm coming. Doom.
Bon Iver.
What's that from?
It's from Hadestown.
Thanks.
Or it's from the, I know the concept album. It's Bon Iver or whatever the fuck his name is on the concept.
Bon Iver?
Bon Iver!
Bon Iver. You know what? Later, everybody.
The theater, the theater.
Theater.